Appeals. It is Wednesday, February 13th. The first case on the calendar for oral argument is the matter of Shelley Yocum versus Ram Mutual Insurance Company. I'd remind each of you that you have 15 minutes to make your argument. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Judge Bjorkman, Judge Flory, Judge Connolly, thank you and good morning, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Dominique Navarre. I represent the appellant, Shelley Yocum, in this matter. Ms. Yocum appeals a final decision of the Goodhue County District Court on a respondent's cross motion for summary judgment, giving this court jurisdiction under Minnesota statute. The court today is confronted with three issues, two of which involve the interpretation of an insurance contract, and one involves a review of the district court's determination that a genuine issue of material fact failed to exist, all of which are questions of law that this court reviews de novo. The first issue is number one.
Both parties move for summary judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So that suggests the lack of a fact issue, doesn't it?
It suggests, Your Honor, but the district court came back and it suggests that, Your Honor, but
both parties could be wrong.
That's correct. Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes. So, and I'll get to that, Your Honor. There are fact issues, and that'll be the third issue that I'll argue here. But the first issue, did the district court err in holding that the action site failed to meet the definition of insured premises, or specifically, did it fail to meet the definition of residential premises, thereby failing to afford the appellant coverage under the insurance policy? Number two, did the district court err in not finding ambiguity in the definition of insured premises, or specifically the residential premises? And number three, did the court err in finding no genuine issue of material fact? Given the wording of the insurance policy, logic, and relevant case law, I believe the answer to all three of those is yes.
So do you agree, Mr. Navarre, that we're really focusing on that part of the policy that says that part of residential premises not owned by insured while temporarily used by insured? Is
Absolutely.
That where our focus should be?
Absolutely, Judge. Yes. Yes. And in fact, the facts in this case are largely undisputed. I mean, there is no dispute between the parties that Mr. Swanson, the insured under the policy, used a golf cart, which was a recreational vehicle, and injured the appellant. I mean, maybe respondent will argue that, but there's really largely no dispute in those facts.
And he wasn't using the golf cart for golfing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was at a motocross race.
That's correct. Correct.
So, given that that is true, I'm wondering. I'm looking again at the part of the policy that Judge Flory just quoted, and that the definition that talks about residential premises being used temporarily by an insured. I mean, that comes under a part of the policy that says under coverages L and M, mm-hmm. this is an additional definition of insured premises. Is the incidental liability coverage part of coverages L and M?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, if you look to the policy, it says that it is in addition to subject to coverages L and M.
It's subject to the terms. Is that the same as saying it's part of coverages L&M?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Yes, so.
But then it turns on whether this was residential premises in terms of anybody's use of it.
Absolutely,
property.
Your Honor. Absolutely. And what the district court found and what they held is they accepted the respondent's argument that the premises should be characterized according to how it was used that day and not the appellant's argument, which we provided and asked the court to take judicial notice that the premises was, in fact, zoned as residential at that time. So the district court came back and under paragraph 16 of the court's order, and I quote, the court found that Mr. Swanson did not sleep there, nor was there any evidence he entered any building on the land, that the evidence indicates he used the land as a motocross raceway. So here the court, again, accepts a respondent's argument that—
Is that wrong? Was he camping there? I mean, was there any evidence that he was using it as a residential purposes on a temporary basis?
There is no evidence that he was using it, no.
Was anybody using this property where which I know is referred to as the Midway Recreation Park? Is there evidence that anybody was residing permanently or temporarily at that premises?
Absolutely. Actually, the motocross speedway was built right behind the owner's house. The owners are Cynthia and Jack Stamshore. They built the property right behind their home.
The property being the racetrack.
That's correct. Correct. And there is evidence to support the idea that there were people, other guests, so to speak, that were camping at the property. So yes, there is evidence. There is no evidence to suggest that Mr. Swanson was camping at the property, but he was definitely temporarily using it, and he didn't own the property. So under paragraph 5, it really, again, hinges on what is a residential premises. Now, again, respondent wants this court to believe that a premises should be characterized by the way it's used, right? But that flies in the face of the other provisions in the contract. If I call your attention to paragraph 10...
This is homeowner's policy, right?
That's
correct,
Your Honor.
Don't we all kind of start from the proposition that the liability being insured against, whether it's for property damage or for personal liability claims, you know, should be tethered to some extent with the insured property?
Well, we start there, I think, Your Honor, but when a policy has other provisions and expands the definition of an insured premises, we are allowed to go there, so to speak, right? Because
shouldn't the extension be commensurate with the risk undertaken? That is, I mean, maybe that is, you know, the use of this other property as a residence, as a substitute, if you will, for the premises that is identified in the declaration page of the homeowner's policy.
That's not specifically what the insured premises is defined as, though, Your Honor. If you look to paragraph 4, for example, an insured premises also includes your cemetery lots and burial vaults or those of your resident relatives. There is no requirement that any of these need to be used or for residential purposes. In fact, there are provisions in the contract that require that certain parcels and certain buildings be used for residential purposes. In fact, under 10A2, under the definitions of insured premises, which is just above, right above the paragraph 5, the insured premises also includes, and I quote, if the residence is a townhouse or a row house, item 2 above includes related private structures and grounds at that location used or occupied solely by your household for residential premises.
So purposes, yeah.
I'm sorry, purposes. So it contemplates and requires that a townhouse, while is, I guess, residential in nature and certainly zoned residential, that it's required, it must be required that you use those buildings and those lands for residential purposes. Likewise, under the definitions, the general definitions of business, which is paragraph 4 of the general definitions, a business is characterized and defined under certain ways, but it, and I quote, does not include the occasional rental for residential purposes of the part of the insured premises normally occupied by your household. So suggesting that a business, that an insured is allowed to rent out their basement, for example, which is is defined as a business under the terms of the policy, but that's not going to be considered a business because you're renting it for residential purposes, right? So the respondent knew to require certain instances and certain buildings to be used for residential purposes, but that's not what paragraph 5 says. It does not say it must residential premises has to be used for purposes for residential purposes. So, I cited a couple examples to the district court, and I'll use a different one here. If an insured, for example, has a home and they can't live in it for whatever reason, whether it's a pipe burst or what have you, and they have to live in a hotel, for example, for a month. Obviously, they're in that hotel temporarily. They're living there, bathing there, sleeping there. All right, so
they're using it as a residence.
Exactly. Yes, but are we to believe that under paragraph 5, because they're using it for residential purposes, that there should be coverage? Well, of course not. I wouldn't argue that because that's a commercial property, right? And I think that's a great question to ask respondent when he comes up here, is under paragraph 5, under those circumstances, because your argument is you have to characterize it according to how it's used, is there coverage under paragraph 5 in those circumstances? And one, he says, no, I think this court has to overturn the district court for that reason. Because, what is the test here? Is it how the property is used or how it's zoned? Again, I asked the district court to take judicial notice that this property was zoned residential. It didn't require that it be used for residential purposes, but the district court came back
And yet the definition of residence means a building used principally for family residential purposes. Doesn't tie it to any zoning requirement or anything like that.
It doesn't, Your Honor, but here again, I mean, we're talking a contract here. It doesn't require that the residential premises be used for residential purposes. And again, the respondent knew to use that in other provisions. It did not in paragraph 5. And also, respondent urges that the zoning of the property is immaterial. But under Minnesota zoning laws, chapter 394, the use of the property must conform to how the property is zoned and not the other way around. That same logic should be used here. I mean, if the courts are going to allow an insurance company to determine the use of the property and determine whether or not there's coverage as a result of the use, I mean, that provides a certain subjective and arbitrary test for the insurance in favor of the insurance company to deny coverage. But that's not what this contract says. This contract does not require that this residential premise, zoned residential, be used for residential purposes. Respondent also urges that my client has provided no legal authority to support their position, but yet respondent has provided zero legal authority to support the idea that a piece of property should be characterized based on how it's used and not how it's zoned. For those reasons, Your Honor, with regard to that first issue, we asked that the district court overturn. I'm sorry, the court overturned the district court. Now, with regard to the second issue, again, the reading of that paragraph 5, and I'll always refer to paragraph 5, it reads, that part of residential premises not owned by an insured while temporarily used by an insured. It almost has a three-part test to it. The second five words, not owned by an insured. There's no question that Mr. Swanson didn't own the property. The second six words, while temporarily used by an insured, there's no question that Mr. Swanson temporarily used the property. But that part of residential premises, what is that? How is that defined? Now, it can be read, obviously, this sentence, in a three-part element, with three-part elements, but that's what the district court did. The district court, in its ruling, Judge Bailey extracted a portion of the applicable sentence in the policy and said, and I quote, Midway Recreation Park was a residential premises, ... temporarily used by the insured, emphasis added, end quote. Then Judge Bailey goes on and talks about how Swanson didn't sleep there, didn't go in any buildings, et cetera, but that's not how the provision reads. But yet, Judge Bailey extracted the five words out of the sentence and read it one way when it could have been read another. And that's the definition of ambiguous.
So what's the operative term? Isn't it residential? I mean, isn't that the operative term in terms of the issue before our court?
I think it could be, Your Honor, yes. But
then we go back to definition number 8, which defines resident in terms of principal use. I mean, isn't that how the whole notion of how property is being used becomes relevant?
But I think here again, Judge, I think it's that provides a certain degree of subjectivity and arbitrary, it allows an insurance adjuster to go out and determine, well, is this residential? How is it being used? I mean, it's very subjective and arbitrary, Your Honor. So I think that the zoning requirement, I mean, if it's zoned residential, why is that not just as operative? Why is that not just as...
If it's zoned residential and no one has ever developed the land, there are no buildings on it at all, there's just this makeshift motocross raceway in the middle of property that is zoned residential, would you be making the same argument?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just because of the zoning.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, Your Honor. So, I mean, because here again, I mean, we're dealing with a contract. Does this contract require, and which Mr. Swanson's paying good money for this, monthly premiums, does it require that this piece of property be used for residential purposes?
Does the record indicate, Mr. Navarro, what the monthly premium was?
I don't recall, okay. Your Honor. I'm sorry. So,
the record indicate whether... This, if I use this word, motocross raceway had whether a separate insurance policy was taken out for that, for that property.
We don't have that in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, yep. Thank you.
So, but what Judge Bailey did?
And then I guess, sorry. So, what did they race on this thing? I mean, is it like go karts or
motorcycles? Yeah, dirt bikes. Yep, so, but what Judge Bailey did, and back to this just real briefly, is Judge Bailey despite the fact that it didn't say it, didn't specify that it needed to be used for residential purposes, he effectively inserted the must be used for residential purposes in his order. Without saying it, but for all intents and purposes, he required that. He made the requirement that this be used for residential purposes when it did not specify that. But regardless, the provision can be read in one of two different ways. Again, definition of ambiguous, we ask the court to resolve that in favor of the insured. With respect to the third issue, the genuine issue of material fact, again, we presented evidence that this piece of property is zoned residential. Respondent took the position that it's used commercially. We have competing facts here. And it appears to me that Judge Bailey, if I may finish up real briefly.
You know, you will have 5 minutes for
rebuttal.
I'll stop you here. And
thank you,
we'll see what respondent has to say, and you may have different remarks after his argument. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Dan Bellig. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Ram Mutual Insurance Company. Ram's position in this case is that in the ordinary sense, the term residential premises excludes from its scope areas used for commercial, spectator sport, or not otherwise used primarily for day-to-day family residential life.
But what about where you have kind of a mixed-use premises, where you've got, I don't think it's disputed that there is a home on this property, but the homeowners have chosen to use part of their property for purposes of this recreation park where motocross racing occurs.
Right, Your Honor, and we raised the mixed-use analogy in our brief and explain, take it out of this context for a second and look at things you might see up here in the Twin Cities where, for example, you have apartment units that are built on top of commercial enterprises on the bottom. Now, you may have, you know, that entire parcel may be one taxable property, may have one parcel ID, may be taxed one way, may be zoned one way. But within that, you have multiple distinct premises. So in no ordinary sense would we say, oh, you know, I went to the retail store below, I was injured, that was a residential premises. Even though they're within the same parcel, there's different uses. So what we need to look at...
So is this particular parcel zoned commercial and residential?
If you look at the taxable the tax data provided by the appellant in this matter, get the exact affidavit for you here. Give me a second. I believe it's the May 3rd affidavit of Mr. Navarro, Exhibit A. And the way it's classified, the way I read it, is it's homestead agricultural or non-homestead residential. So I think there's actually, the tax records themselves acknowledge that there's a mixed use of this property. There may be a home or a residence on the property, but there's also an agricultural component to what is a 40-plus acre parcel. And that's not uncommon. So, you know, in rural areas, you'll see a small homestead on maybe a one-acre building site, and then a farmer may have 180 acres. And if something occurs, you know, on the far end of the property, we, as a matter of common sense or ordinary usage, wouldn't understand that part of the property to be part of the residential premises.
Is there any cases that would suggest that you're right?
I couldn't find any. So what I'm using, basically, Your Honor, is... straight-up contract interpretation. We give you the definition of premises and what premises is defined as it can mean a particular part of the property, a property as a whole. So it has a broad application, but when you look at the policy and you look at the context, which plain contract interpretation requires you to do, that modifier, residential, is what's going to lead you in the direction here.
Mr. Bellick, you know, as the drafter of this policy, couldn't your client have taken care of this very easily by writing an exclusion into the policy, something to the effect that any commercial use of residential premises are excluded from coverage under these incidental coverage provisions? I mean, the contract is construed against a drafter. It would seem that would make it crystal clear what's covered and what isn't under these circumstances.
Could you state the exclusion wording for me one more time?
I made it up as I was going along here, so I won't guarantee you that I'll say it again, but some exclusion to the extent of any temporary use of residential premises for commercial purposes are excluded from coverage under the policy?
Yeah, so they could do that, but I think their insureds might squawk a little bit, because think of this scenario. Think of a scenario where you have a 40-acre parcel and you have your residence, and then maybe a quarter acre away you have a large shop building, and you do woodworking or you run your construction company out of there. In that case, we have two separate premises, as I've been arguing here, but you also have situations, for example, where someone may work out of their home, but they do it out of an office next to their bedroom. And I don't think the insurance company would want to exclude that, because that is a part of the property that would still nonetheless, even though it has a commercial component, be part of something that may be used in ordinary family life on a day-to-day basis.
Even if they were like manufacturing firecrackers? You're telling me you'd cover that because I do it out of my home office?
Well, we would then have a factual issue. And there's another component here, too. I mean, why this isn't going to come up is because most homeowners' policies do, in fact, have a business exclusion. So the context is important, and maybe that's where this is getting mixed up. It's not the homeowner that's being sued here. So if the homeowner had done something related to the motocross and been sued, there wouldn't be coverage because of our business exclusion. What they're trying to do is get coverage for third-party liability. So if a third party did something inside the residence, maybe then there would be some coverage
On that note, let me give you an example. So this is apparently a 40-acre parcel out in the country. You know, it's very common that, you know, people sell vegetables, and they often do it sort of, you know, close to the road. So if you see the vegetables, you can stop in, pull in the driveway, and, you know, buy some apples or potatoes or something. Let's say under this policy at this address, this person is doing that, and I drive off the road, and I go up and I buy some potatoes, and while I'm there, I trip and fall down. Okay, so I'm a third party. Does this policy cover that injury?
So you're a third party who tripped
on the premises, tripped while I was buying some potatoes that, you know, they sell, and I don't know, maybe they grow them on some of the 40 acres, maybe they don't, but they've got that little business.
And you're suing the policyholder.
You got it.
Okay. Likely not, because like I say, there's probably a business exclusion here.
Okay.
So and that's where I think, Judge Flory, maybe your question, it makes sense in a different context, but not here, because what we have is the property owner's not being sued. So these business exclusions just don't really operate. It's sort of a bizarre scenario where someone else is trying to attach a homeowner's policy for a different piece of property to cover an injury that occurred on someone else's premises that's used, in this part at least, for business purposes.
Now, let's say, for the sake of argument, I wasn't going there to buy potatoes. I was going there to say hello to my friend, and I slip and fall, and I sue them. Am I covered under the policy? Or will you pay for will you defend the homeowner for that claim that I'm making, saying, you know, you should have, I don't know, let's go with winter, you should have shoveled the walk or something?
So, right, again,
I'm suing the policyholder.
I think if you're going there in the ordinary course, it's a standard slip and fall accident, that typically that would be covered under general liability provisions. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Do you agree with counsel for appellant that the reference in the incidental liability coverage form to, I'm quoting, these coverages are subject to all the terms of coverages L and M, that language in and of itself sweeps in this expanded definition of insured premises that we're talking about?
Yes, that's how I read the policy. Okay. Yeah, I think we all agree that particular definition is the operative factor here.
So then we look at number 10, the definition of insured premises, which includes both the standard definition and this expanded definition. And as counsel for appellant points out, I mean, there are certain of the definitional sections that specifically require that premises be used for residential purposes. And this particular exclusion, or this particular definitional provision doesn't have that kind of language. Doesn't that suggest that appellant is right, that it is not tied to temporary use as a residence? Or temporary use by the insured as a residence?
My position on that, Your Honor, is that that's sort of immaterial. So take the situation. Let's assume that the house that's pictured there is actually occupied and used as a residence. Let's assume that to be the case. That doesn't change the scenario for us, because what I'm suggesting to the court is that, you know, with the mixed use analogy, the curtilage arguments, that you have separate uses of the property, and what we're looking at is the situs of the injury. And what was that? That was not a residential premises. So if you change the facts and say, well, let's say that this home was not occupied at all and someone was using it for illicit purposes and that sort of thing, still doesn't change, because we're not looking at that part of the property to determine whether the injury occurred within a residential premises, if that makes sense.
Because where the Midway Recreational Park, that part of this property was not a residence.
Right. So within one taxable parcel, you can have multiple different premises here, and we have this operative word, residential, which would seem to exclude a raceway, at least in the ordinary sense.
So do you agree then that under the provision, that part of residential premises not owned by insured, in this case Swanson or whoever the insured was, while temporarily used by Swanson, do you agree that Mr. Policyholder Swanson was temporarily using the property, but you're concentrating on, in your argument, whether or not this commercial operation, the motocross track, was a residential premise?
We would agree that he was on the parcel, using a portion of the parcel. So
right.
we don't dispute that part of it. What we dispute is whether the situs here was a residential premises. Yeah.
And is that a dispute of fact or dispute of contract terms? What?
Well, it could be either, depending on how you look at it. We don't think there's a factual issue here, because no one has suggested that this part of the property actually has any residential use to it. It's a racetrack. It was used for spectating. And as I noted, the tax records don't really help us there, because the tax records acknowledge that there are different uses for this property. They're not really dispositive of that. So,
does the proximity of the residence to the commercial operation, or the access to the commercial operation as opposed to the residence, I mean, are those fact issues that a jury would look at to determine under these circumstances where residence and premises aren't defined in the contract to, are those fact issues that would be looked at as opposed to a motocross track back on the back corner of the property away from the premises? And I don't know what the record for sure develops, if at all, in that regard, but would that be something that would be looked at to resolve this in terms of whether it's a legal issue or a factual issue?
Right, so if you look at our discussion of the curtilage issue, they have a four-factor analysis that you go through, and proximity and that stuff is part of that. But one of the prevailing factors that they have is the use, you know. So the area where this happened, I mean, there, you could raise a factual issue, but here there is none. I mean, there's deposition testimony as to what was going on at the site. So you could hypothetically get into a case where you have, for example, the one-acre building site, and you know, and then, you know, quarter mile down or, you know, quarter block down or something, you have your large shed. Well, now where's the line, you know, if you don't have a fence up or something? But here there's nothing in the record to indicate that the site of the injury was anywhere close to the home or within what we would consider that curtilage type area.
Did anybody address in the record whether or not this commercial operation was a non-conforming use in terms of how the property was zoned?
I don't think there was no discovery here. What we have from the depositions is from the underlying action. I think that's just, we can presume that based on the tax record and the deposition testimony as to the actual use. I'll check my notes here, Your Honor. I think we covered most everything. unless there are more questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Navarro, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just real briefly. I think we covered about everything, but I just want to point out there that Judge Flory, I think you're correct. There are fact issues here, I think, where the accident occurred, along with the characterization of the tax, the fact that it's zoned residential, and that, I mean, there are tax issues for the finder of fact, and I think that's why the summary judgment was inappropriate in this matter. And with respect to the...
Well, I mean, if it was zoned industrial, I would... If this property was zoned industrial, you'd be making the same argument. I mean, who cares? It's residential premises, and, you know, there's no exclusion. So I guess I'm not so sure... You know, that's their problem. I mean, if they were too stupid enough to insure, you know, industrial property thinking it was a residential property, who cares? I think we look first at the definitions under the contract, wouldn't we, Mr. Navarro?
Yeah, no, I agree, Your Honor. I mean, if this was zoned industrial, I don't think we'd be standing here right now, right? But it wasn't. It was zoned residential and agricultural. But here again, and you're right, this is a contract issue, right? It does not say that this piece of property had to be used for residential purposes. And I think, Judge Flory, you make a good point. You had mentioned that as the drafter, the responder certainly could have put any provision in there they would have liked, but they didn't. They didn't specify that this piece of property had to be used for residential purposes. There is no exclusion, as Your Honor had mentioned. These types of contracts are held against the drafter.
So what is the significance, then, of the policy definition of the word residence?
I don't know that
that's irrelevant to to how we should interpret residential premises?
I think it is in this circumstance, Your Honor. Yeah, because here again, I mean, it's, I think that's allowing the insurance company to, again, to make some arbitrary decision with regard to, unilaterally determine whether or not this residence or how it was used is residential. I mean, I just don't think that applies right now. I don't think residential premises, is it how it's used or how it's characterized or how it's taxed? I mean, what is the test here? That's the problem.
Well, then you're really asking us to disregard the word residential. I mean, if 10b-5 just said insured premises also includes that part of premises not owned by an insured while temporarily used by insured, I think your argument would go a lot farther with me, but it has this word residential in there.
Sure.
And given the fact that the policy defines residence, I'm not sure how residential premises becomes an ambiguous term.
Well, I think because it's a residential premise, it's not just a residence. A residence is defined under the policy as, I'm sorry, you didn't say.
Building used principally for family residential purposes. And you're saying that leaves the whole yard around the building.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if this accident occurred 10 feet from the house, would we...
Well, if it wasn't at a racetrack. I mean, I think those are different facts. I agree with you there.
Yeah, but if that racetrack is zoned residential, it's a residential premises not used... I mean, I think that this is a different circumstance. So the residence, Your Honor, I don't think we disregard that, but under these circumstances, that's specifying the house, the dwelling.
What about the argument that this property is zoned both residential and agricultural?
Well, I think now we have a fact issue. They're making summary judgment inappropriate. So...
Well, did you argue that in the district court, that was a fact issue?
Absolutely. I'd have to...
Okay.
Look at the trend. I'm thinking back here, Your Honor. I'm sorry. But yes, actually, no, we did because I asked the court to take judicial notice that this parcel was, in fact, zoned residential. We provided the tax statement, so we did make the argument, absolutely. Yeah, So given the circumstances, given that this is really a contract issue, Judge Cowley, as you point out and as you suggest, Judge Flory, the contract should be held in favor of the insured. We ask that the court overturn the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.